Mr. James, Reel 1, how and when did you come to be in the Army, please?
Well, I was out in India at the time, so, because my father was in the Indian Army. And when war was declared, all the British residents voluntarily said that they would volunteer for the Army. And from the age of 16, we had to register. And when we were 18, we were called up. This was to make certain, of course, that the Indian Army had a good number of officers who knew the Indians and could speak the language.
What job had you been doing in India?
I was only a schoolboy.
Whereabouts?
In Pune, which is near Bombay.
What had your father done in India, exactly?
He was in the Indian Army for a while, and then he left for a while to start up a motor business, and then of course he was on the Army Reserve, and he went back again into the transport. He was a colonel in the the transport.
Had you been born in Pune?
I was born in Bombay. Yes. In those days, of course, a lot of the Indian Army, of course, everyone was born out there and lived out there.
What happened to you when you were called up?
I was accepted for a commission. I went to the officers' training school at Bangalore for about 6 months until I was commissioned in October 1942 to the 8 Gurkha Rifles, who at that time had their regimental centre at Quetta, up in the northwest of India, on the borders of Iran, or Persia, as it was called then.
Were the Gurkhas your own choice?
Yes, at OTS you were allowed 3 choices, and I put down 3 Gurkha regiments and got one of them.
Why did you want to be a Gurkha officer?
Mainly because one heard so much about them, and marvellous people they were to serve with. And events proved this to be true.
Can you tell me about the character of the 8th Gurkhas then?
The 8th Gurkha Rifles at that time was, like any Gurkha regiment, had a regimental centre, and it had 2 battalions, one of which was in Burma, and the other one was served in Italy, I believe, and that part of the campaign. Yeah.
Whereabouts in Nepal did they recruit from?
Well, as they were, 8 Gurkha Rifles took what we called Magar Gurungs, that meant Western Nepal. So they were mainly from Western Nepal, because the 9 Gurkhas only take Chetris from the Kathmandu Valley, and the 10th and the 7th used to take mainly people from the eastern Nepal, like the Rai Nimbus. Although in wartime, of course, there was such a demand for Gurkhas and the casualty list was so high that in the end there was a fair mixture in all the regiments, I would say.
What impression did the Gurkha soldier make on you when you first arrived at Quetta?
Well, it took a little time, of course, for me to get to know them, and I was only there actually for a couple of months before I was suddenly transferred to the 3rd Second Gurkha Rifles to go on Wingate's first Chindit expedition. So I had a very brief, I suppose, acquaintance with the Gurkhas of the 8th Gurkha Rifle, anyway. I was a company lieutenant, and it was a case of getting to know. The language, of course, was most important, but and I had to learn that. But I didn't have a real opportunity of getting to know, I should think, the actual individuals in such a short space of time. But when I went to the 3rd Second, of course, it was a bit different because I was with them into Burma.
Did you have any difficulties adjusting to the Gurkha soldier?
No difficulty at all. because their nature is such that they are very easy people to get to know. But and they accept you on face value, and of course you have to meet their very high standards, and they won't forgive you if you lower them.
What kind of standards do they insist?
Standards on? Of behavior, standards of courage in action. the main things that they believe very strongly in.
Apart from courage, what kind of behavior do they expect?
Apart from courage, they expect you to to be of to look after their interests and to get to learn their language. And I suppose particularly to be able to have a good sense of humour is very essential, I think, yes.
Do they play practical jokes on you?
They wouldn't play practical jokes on the officer, no. They play practical jokes on each other. And they don't mind. There's always some one person in the platoon or company who's a butt for the whole lot, and he takes it all in good spirit anyway.
How was it that you came to transfer to the 3rd, 2nd Gurkhas?
Well, out of the blue came an order saying that three of us were required to go on a company commander's course at Jhansi in central India. There were three of us, and one was Ian McHorton, and the other one was Alec Gibson, and then it was myself. And we were all second lieutenants, and no one knew quite what this order was, but it was from a very high authority, and so the three of us were sent off to Jhansi. And I remember we arrived there, it was about January 1943, we arrived there in the darkness, and there's a great big camp in the race course. And we were met by the adjutant, who said, "You know why you're here?" And we said, "Yes, we've come on a company commander's course." And he said, "Oh, no, you haven't." He said, "You're going into Burma." "Oh, by the way," he said, "have you made your wills?" Which gave us a bit of a scare. Because two of us were only 19, my friend Ian and myself, and Alec was about 20. So and we hadn't a clue. So there we were, pitchforked suddenly into Wingate's Chindits.
Did you feel annoyed or deceived?
Not at all. Not at all.
What did you feel? Excited about
it? We felt excited, I should think, yes. Young men usually do.
And then what happened to you?
Well, I must say, though, as this is going on record, that it was probably a big mistake that Wingate made, in that just he'd been training the brigade for several months, very hard training, and then suddenly, perhaps just a few weeks before we went in, he suddenly had to bring in something like, I would say, 1,200 or more Gurkha troops and British officers who hadn't a clue of what was intended or, in fact, what the various drills and things were. So that he went into Burma with a lot of untrained people. I hadn't a clue at that stage what we were going into, and only we had to pick it up as we went along. And a lot of he suddenly decided, for example, that there should be the muleteers, even in the British column, should be Gurkhas. And my friend Nick Neal will tell you more about that if you ever get to see him, because he found himself in charge of a Gurkha muleteers in the British column. Gurkha muleteers who were recruits, some of them hadn't even fired a rifle, never even seen a mule. So I think that was the big mistake, and the other thing was that here was myself and there were many British officers in different columns, with men we had never met before. They didn't know us, and we didn't know them. And one thing about Gurkhas is that they like to know their officers. There's a sort of family atmosphere, and this was completely void. And here was I pitchforked into a column, and I had to almost from the word go, had almost the time we get into action, I had to try and learn about my men, and they had to learn about me. Mind you, it was in our column. It worked, mainly, I think, because the column commander was Michael Calvert, who was an amazing man and a great leader, who I came to admire tremendously. But he couldn't speak Gurkhali, and he had to rely on Captain George Silcock to translate for him. But as I say, the Gurkhas can recognize in somebody if they have something above the normal average, and they recognize in Calvert that here was a man they could follow. And the fact that he couldn't speak their language was, in the end, was not a barrier. So anyway, that's what happened, you see, when he arrived suddenly in the dark at the race course at Chansey and pitchforked into this thing. And I think another point which really, I suppose at the time I didn't grasp, was that we were suddenly told, at least the officers were told, but not the men, that if anybody was wounded and couldn't keep up with a column, he would have to be left in a village. And if he was seriously wounded, he had to be helped on his way with a lethal dose of morphia. And others, like myself, were given a supply of these little capsule things, looked like toothpaste tubes. And I must admit, at the time, I never thought anything of it. But it was something that eventually, sometime afterwards, had a great effect on the morale of not only the Gurkha troops, but the British troops as well. The fact that, you know, if you're going to be wounded, you've had it, or if you've been seriously wounded, there's no way you can get back. You're 100 miles inside the country. You're going to be given a lethal dose. And it was a very difficult situation, but one which there was no way that Wingate at that time could have done anything else. It was a very tricky situation. I mean, because at that those days, the use of aircraft, you see, was very limited.
We'll come on to the specifics of that a bit later, but what happened after you were first met? What happened the next day?
Well, the next day I had to have all the various injections and vaccinations in one go, TAB and what have you, which rather put me out for one night. And after that, I learned, for example, that it was because of the nature of the operation, certainly the officer didn't have to wear a normal uniform as such. And I was taken to Chansey so I could buy some whipcord trousers or corduroys and various things like that. The men themselves, of course, wore their regulation uniforms. And then it was a case of getting to know the officers and the men, if possible. But it was only a matter of a week, I should think, and we were on our way by train up, you know, to Brahmaputra and up towards Dimapur.
What was the name of Calvert's column?
That was number 3. Did you want to know the setup of the column? It was 77, Wingate 77 Indian Infantry Brigade. And it was broken up into, there was a British battalion, a Gurkha battalion, a Burma Rifle Battalion. There was a company of commandos who were, and there was some signalers, RAF, and some medical. This is the main construction of it. And it was broken up originally. They had 8 columns, but one was disbanded before we went in. So eventually there were 7 columns. Each column was, about a company strength plus the mules. We probably had about 80 to 100 horses and mules, and some bullocks as well with each column. So I think you're talking about 350 men altogether, plus horses and mules, and at first bullocks. And in each column there was a company of either Gurkhas or British troops, plus a section of commandos, British commandos, an RAF team, army signalers, and we had and a doctor. That was more or less the build-up of the column. The company, of course, was three platoons. This was the build-up.
What about your journey to Dimapur?
Well, we went by train, and memory being what it is, I can't all remember every bit of it, but I do know we probably went to the Brahmaputra first and crossed by ferry, I would think, to Dimapur. And when we arrived at Dimapur, we gathered there for a while, and then from Dimapur we had to march all the way up to Imphal, which we did at night at first. In those days, of course, the word chindit had not been invented, and we were called long cloth. That was the code word. And we went by night because, for security reasons, but so we marched by columns right up this road, which at that time, of course, was still being built, the Kohima Road. And we'd have somebody in front with a lantern, and one in the back, like the old days of motoring in this country, with the red light in front. And we'd walk most of the night, and then during the day we'd lay up in some camp somewhere. And the next night we did this. We did this for about, I think it must have been about 10 days. Eventually we marched in the daytime as well, and we reached Imphal itself, where we stayed for about, I think, at least 10 days. And, of course, during the march and the days, I tried to get to know the various men, which was very difficult, actually, because of the circumstances of the marching and so on.
What happened at Imphal?
Well, at Imphal, we visited Imphal, and where at the golf club, Wingate had his headquarters. And he had this large room, which was absolutely, the floor was covered with maps. And every day we'd go in by columns, the officers, and we'd have to go into this room on our stocking feet with Wingate. And while he went round, sort of gave us ideas of what might happen.
Why stocking feet?
Because the maps, we were covered on the maps, were all along the wall. We sort of crawled along the awning, if you like. I have a photograph, actually, of him on there, if you want to see it later. And that was the idea. And the funny thing was, what happened was, you see, there was an anteroom. It was very cold. I mean, you mightn't realize it, but at that time of the year, it was late January, early February, up in the mountains. It was very cold, bitterly cold. And each column would wait in the anteroom while the other one was being briefed by Wingate. And there was always a lot of rum to drink. And when one column went in, and they had a Canadian doctor. Now, Wingate had this habit. He had a flit pump on the windowsill, you see. And every now and then he'd get the flit pump and go, pit, 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 you see. Oh, it's dreadful. Anyway, this
what was he doing this for?
Flies or mosquitoes or something, I don't know. we just took it in our stride, of course. But this column had been waiting a bit of time, I think, and this doctor had a bit too much to drink. And Wingate, so, and he kept doing this, you see, and eventually Wingate said, any questions? And he said, the doctor said, tell me, he says, why do you have to use that goddamn flit pump? And Wingate looked startled, considering the person he was, that was some achievement. What do you mean, he said? It's bloody insanitary, the doctor. "Get him out," said Wingate. And all the officers quickly got hold of the doctor and rushed out of the room.
Did he sound intoxicated?
Yes, I believe he did. I wasn't there. I was told the story, obviously, by my friends who were with him. It was a different column. It passed off anyway, but that was it. But the thing is, you see, what we didn't realise at the time, and I only found out much later, being only a junior officer, was that while we waited at Imphal, there was great doubt on whether the expedition would go through or not. Because, I don't know if you know the background to it, but do you know what the reason?
Yes.
You know the background, yes. Do you? Well, then you know that the last moment they decided we were supposed to go in first and then the push behind us. Well, as you know, the last moment they decided, well, Joe Stillwell decided he couldn't get his Chinese, and 23 Division and Wavell decided that they weren't ready. However, Wingate managed to persuade Wavell, I don't think it's very difficult to persuade him, that we should go in anyway and to see what happened. And so that's what happened, and we were given the word and we moved off.
Before we go into Burma, what did you make of Wingate yourself when you met him personally?
I only met him once before we went in. That was at Dimapur, when I think it was one day in Dimapur when Calvert and I were talking somewhere, and suddenly Wingate appeared from nowhere, and Calvert sort of just introduced me, and I got the cold stare, you see, who's this insignificant second defendant, and that was that. So I didn't actually ever even speak to Wingate, come to think of it. Mainly, as I say, because, like so many of us, we just joined the last moment. But, of course, I was told all about him and everything else, and I have to base my opinions on what happened subsequently. And I would say that he was certainly a remarkable officer as far as unconventional warfare was concerned. He was not a general in the same class as Smith, as Slim, for example. I also think that he was a very ruthless person, and that there were certain things, I think, that he did or ordered to be done, which were probably necessary, perhaps, in the light of the expedition, but which I still think was wrong.
Such as?
Some of which I don't think I shall go into, even at this stage. But let's say that, I can admire the man for being what he was in some way, but the other thing, I think his flaw was that he was too ruthless and too egoistic, I think, personally.
What did he look like?
When I first saw him, he had his beard. He was wearing his famous solar topi. He was a handsome man, I should think, yes, good bearing. Later, when I saw him afterwards, of course, he had his big beard and looked like, as though he stepped out of the Bible. And, of course, as you know, he was very fond of quoting Bible, making Bible quotations on the radio, and most of which the recipients didn't understand the meaning of anyway. But and then I suppose I met, and I did meet him again, I come to think of it, at Imphal, when we came out, and he'd shaved and everything else, and he came to say goodbye to the battalion. Battalion he had, without doubt, almost destroyed. The Gurkha battalion. And that was the last I saw of him.
what do you think his attitude was towards Gurkhas specifically?
Well, he was a man who... He did not like the Indian Army. He was a gunner, you see, as well, to begin, among other things, not an infantry person, which is why he made some very tactical mistakes. He had no choice over what he was given. He afterwards did say, and I think people mistakenly did say, that he said he only wanted untried troops, which of course was absolutely incorrect. He was given what he was given because most of the senior officers, apart from Wavell, thought that he was a crank, and they weren't going to, at that time of the war, risk first-class, first-line troops with him. So he was given a British battalion of Kings, who were really garrison troops, and a Gurkha battalion, which had only just been formed. So, I've lost the track. Sorry.
Well, you were giving your estimate of him and what he thought in particular
Gurkhas,
of the Gurkhas.
That's right, I beg your pardon, yes. So he had to accept them, and he made no attempt to learn anything about them at all. I mean, for example, deciding to put Gurkha muleteers in a British column, for example. He also was a man who couldn't be told. I mean, for the Gurkha British officers, the senior officers, couldn't really tell him, because he had kept everything under tight control. But he didn't realize, of course, that the main power of a Gurkha battalion is this family tradition. They fight as a battalion, and as such, they are marvelous. But he was going to ask them to do something which was quite contradictory. You're going to be split up and all over the place. Wounded were going to be left, and the tradition of the Gurkha regiments was you bring your wounded back, and you're dead if you can. He was putting officers in with them who knew nothing about them, including myself. I mean, I didn't know who they personally, who they were. I had to learn the names as I went along. There were many of us, or them, who couldn't speak the language. The British officers couldn't speak the language. He put British officers to command columns who couldn't speak the language. Mind you, with Calvert, he was fortunate, because Calvert was a most exceptional person. And he also had, if I may say so, a very good team under him at Calvert. And Calvert got to know and admire and love the Gurkhas and to respect them. But Wingate made no attempt.